From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, India swears in Prime Minister as South Asian leaders watch. Thai coup leader says he's received King's blessing. The peace process amid military strikes against the Taliban. These stories and more on this Tuesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. India's new Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, is promising to forge a strong and inclusive India after being sworn into office. From New Delhi, Anjana Pasricha reports, South Asian leaders, including Pakistan's Prime Minister, attended the inauguration.
I, Narendra Damodar Das Modi.
As the sun was about to set on the Indian capital, President Pranab Mukherjee administered the oath of office to Narendra Modi before a packed audience assembled before the stately presidential palace in New Delhi. The 63-year-old son of a tea stall owner and his Bharatiya Janata Party won the biggest electoral victory in three decades on the promise of ushering change. After he was sworn in, a statement on the Prime Minister's website said, "Let us dream of a strong, developed and inclusive India that actively engages with the world community and strengthens the cause of world peace." The BJP leader's new style was evident as leaders of South Asian countries joined the swearing-in ceremony, boosting Mr. Modi's profile on the diplomatic stage. The most closely watched dignitary was Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who said he comes to India with a message of peace. He told NDTV News Channel that the strong mandate the two leaders have could help them turn a page in relations, and the two longtime rivals should remove fears about each other. He called it a great opportunity. The heads of Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, Nepal, Bhutan, Maldives, Mauritius, and the Speaker of Bangladesh's Parliament also attended the ceremony. Indian commentators called it a South Asia moment. Former top Indian diplomat Lalit Mansingh says Mr. Modi's outreach to South Asia, especially Pakistan, is a gesture of cooperation from India.
I think Mr. Modi realizes that even though his focus is on economic growth by India, he needs a peaceful neighborhood. So this initiative is to ensure that we have good understanding with our neighbors and that the neighbors will allow India to grow economically in peace.
In living up to his pledge of overhauling the government, Mr. Modi will head a leaner administration with 44 ministers, in contrast to the 77 ministers in the outgoing government. In his campaign, Mr. Modi called for minimum government, maximum governance. Several ministries will be combined to make them more efficient. Independent political analyst Neerja Chaudhary says Mr. Modi promises to be decisive and focus on his development agenda.
He wants a purposeful government. Quick decision-making, clearing of bottlenecks is probably going to be the name of the game under him. His focus has been also to take people who were opposed to him and therefore not start on a discordant note, take everybody along.
Mr. Modi's first day in office Tuesday will be spent meeting the South Asian leaders. The most critical will be his interaction with the Pakistani leader, which will set the tone of their future ties. The two countries have not held a formal dialogue in 2 years, but hopes have been raised that they could pick up the threads of the peace process. India and Pakistan have fought 3 wars since their independence from Britain. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Narendra Modi has already had to respond to a national tragedy. He expressed his condolences to the families of the dead as railway officials in northern India report a train accident that has killed at least 30 people and injured 50. Authorities say the train slammed into a parked freight train Monday. Officials say 6 of the train cars were derailed in the crash. Accidents are common on India's massive rail network. Stay tuned as later Daybreak Asia continues its series on Hong Kong politics and the choosing of candidates for the city's next major election. Thailand's coup leader on Monday says the palace has endorsed his takeover of the government. The army chief who carried out the bloodless coup last week also issued a warning about any challenges to military rule. VOA correspondent Steve Herman is close to the action and reports from Bangkok.
General Prayut Chan-o-cha, clad in a dress white uniform, appeared in an army auditorium following the issuance of a royal command, declaring him to be the head of the National Council of Peace and Order to run the country. The document states that the army chief had warned the palace that violence in Bangkok and other parts of the country was likely to spread and may jeopardize national security. The general told reporters he hopes the problems will be solved soon, so he can return to the right democratic system. The army chief says it is preferable to have a prime minister and elections soon, but he is giving no timeline for achieving that. The general seized power last Thursday, ousting the caretaker cabinet 2 days after he declared martial law in effect. These actions came following more than 6 months of political turmoil and low-scale but sometimes fatal violence at sites where rival rallies were being held. The head of the junta is now directly cautioning the media and people communicating online not to incite conflict. The general also warns that soldiers will forcefully crack down on any further political protests. Over the past several days, small but vocal crowds composed of hundreds of people have gathered to oppose the coup in Bangkok. Soldiers and police have been restrained and ultimately not confronted the demonstrators, who appeared mostly to be ordinary citizens, not the hardcore protesters seen at organized rallies in the past. But a Sunday protest did include some recognizable organizers from the Red Shirt Movement, which supported the ousted government of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat, who was taken into military custody last week. Among those at the anti-coup rally Sunday, which occupied for several hours a McDonald's restaurant, was a woman who only wanted to be identified as Belle.
Ordinary people just who anti the coup just come out. That's it. No leaders.
No leaders.
So everyone just responsible for this country, so that's why they come out.
What do you think is going to happen next?
We don't know what to say because, you know, it's very difficult to get the situation at the moment because the junta government is very, very fierce at the moment. So what are we going to continue to protest like this?
Receiving the blessing of Thailand's revered King Bumibol Adunadet is a critical step in establishing the ruling junta's legitimacy. Past coup attempts in Thailand that did not earn the king's blessing ultimately failed to overthrow the country's sitting government. The king, who is revered among many in Thailand as a demigod, has not appeared in public since last week's military takeover. The coup leaders said Monday that the 86-year-old monarch was not in the capital and did not meet in person with General Prayut. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The main opposition in Burma, also known as Myanmar, says it will continue its public campaign for constitutional reforms despite warnings from election officials. Following rallies led by Aung San Suu Kyi in Rangoon and Mandalay, National League for Democracy Parliament member Win Tin told VOA Burmese Monday the party strongly believes in gaining public support and will step up its campaign today. He also said the commission's warning is apparently aimed at putting pressure on NLD activities ahead of next year's elections. On Saturday, the UN Special Rapporteur on Burma expressed concern over the military's veto power on constitutional changes, which he said are vital for the country's democratic transition and elections next year. The Pakistani government is taking a more proactive attitude towards Islamist militants after peace talks between the two sides failed to produce any meaningful results. VOA's Kokab Fashori reports that, though the government has not given up on peace talks with the Pakistani Taliban, it has decided not to wait until the militants strike before attacking them.
The Pakistani Taliban, known as Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan or TTP, has been fighting against the government of Pakistan since 2007. Its goal in attacking Pakistani law enforcement personnel and civilians is to disrupt Pakistan's alliance with the United States in the war against terrorism. Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's government has held peace talks with the TTP in recent months, but there has been no breakthrough. And last week, the Pakistani military conducted a major operation in North Waziristan and killed what it termed close to 60 terrorists. Experts like Lisa Curtis of the Heritage Foundation see it as a proactive approach against the militants.
I think what the Pakistan government is doing is pursuing a simultaneous talk and fight strategy. So I would see this recent offensive in North Waziristan as part of that overall strategy.
Muhid Yusuf with Washington's U.S. Institute of Peace says it'll take a long time to fight this kind of insurgency.
What this is going to do is strike the center of gravity of a number of groups. So it's going to strike their physical presence in a way that they will have to be on the run. But over time, they will regroup, reconvene, find other places, and this process will continue.
In Pakistan, opinion on the talks with the TDP has been divided. While some political parties still want to hold peace talks, others are not hopeful about the prospects of success.
Ideally, for the state of Pakistan, talks would continue with the people who want to talk or with the people who feel that they are defeated and will come and negotiate on the state's terms. I don't think the state has got the upper hand to that point yet.
But Lisa Curtis says the Pakistani government can hold talks from the position of strength.
I think the fact that the military has shown it's willing to strike against the militants when it sees that that is the best option to move forward, I think the fact that they've demonstrated that will help give Pakistan leverage in the talks with the TTP.
Many experts believe that if the recent strikes against the Pakistani Taliban manage to decapitate the TTP's strength, then the peace talks can bear some positive results. Kaukab Farshori, VOA News, Washington.
The White House has revealed to reporters the name of the Central Intelligence Agency's top officer in Afghanistan, an apparent accidental release as President Barack Obama was making a previously unannounced visit to the country. The Washington Post says the name of the spy agency chief in the country, who took part in a briefing with Mr. Obama, was on a list of U.S. officials the White House gave to one of its reporters. The Post says the reporter contacted the White House to ask if the CIA station chief's name was meant to be on the list. And a short time later, a new list without the name was distributed to the media. Hong Kong pro-democracy lawmakers took to the streets of a popular shopping district of Hong Kong Island Sunday to promote their plan to hold an unofficial referendum on democratic reform next month. The late June referendum will ask Hong Kong residents if they support calls by pro-democracy activists for the public to be able to nominate candidates for the city's next leadership election in 2017. That's the first time the chief executive post will be filled by universal suffrage. China's central government has denounced the planned referendum by the pro-democracy Occupy Central movement. Beijing says Hong Kong's constitution or basic law requires chief executive candidates to be selected by a committee and display loyalty to the motherland. One of the chief supporters of Occupy Central is Emily Lau, a lawmaker and leader of the Hong Kong Democratic Party. In an interview with Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin, she explained why she believes the public should be involved in the nomination process.
Well, I think the nomination of the candidate is very important because the discussion in Hong Kong right now is surrounding Beijing's suggestion that there should be some form of political censorship or screening whereby people unacceptable to Beijing will not be nominated. We think that is ridiculous. We think the universal suffrage means the people's right to vote and the people's right to stand for election should be free and fair. So we are now trying very hard to persuade Beijing and the powers that be that the nomination committee should be democratically constituted and there should be other forms of nominating candidates whereby, you know, registered voters can nominate and political parties should also be given the right to nominate candidates.
Well, now that the government has ended its consultation period for the public to offer ideas about election arrangements, what is your party going to do next? And how will you try to influence the government and Beijing to eventually produce a reform document that you can accept?
Well, we are talking to all kinds of people, including those who are close to Beijing. And we hope that the public will also speak out very clearly on what they want. But in fact, they have done so. Various opinion surveys conducted by the universities have found that many people support a fair way of nominating candidates. And many of them, of course, prefer a nomination by registered voters. Maybe, you know, 20,000, 30,000 or more voters get together and they can nominate a candidate. And so we will continue to work with people with like minds to push that message home. And of course, there is this Occupy Central campaign, and we support that as a means of using civil disobedience to show our displeasure. But of course, we hope we don't have to resort to that and to have people arrested. But if we are forced, I don't think we will shy from it.
Well, on the topic of Occupy Central, that's a movement that basically threatens to block parts of the central business district of Hong Kong Island later this year if the government does not produce a reform package that's acceptable to the pro-democracy camp. How concerned are you that that kind of sit-in protest will harm Hong Kong's image and its economy, as the critics are warning?
Well, of course, if you have lots of people occupying Central, it will be very difficult for the government to disperse. If you have several hundred or 1,000-odd people, then it's no big problem for the police. So at the end of the day, it is up to the people of Hong Kong whether they want to come and congregate in the streets of the Central Business District to use that action to show their displeasure and their support for democracy. And we think many people, even in the business community, they understand. And actually, they don't want to see it. And we say we don't want to see it. And so long as the government comes up with a package that meets international standards, that provides for free and fair election, a competitive election whereby voters have a choice, Occupy Central will not happen.
I did interview James Tien, the leader of the Liberal Party, recently, and he told me that he thinks the pan-democrats should basically give up the prospect of having a pro-democracy candidate nominated for 2017 because the nominating committee is unlikely, in his view, to approve any such candidate, and basically wait for the next election in 2022 to give Beijing time, as he says, to see that the 2017 system produced a stable government. What do you think of that idea?
I don't think it's on. We fight very hard for democracy for many years. And I don't speak for anybody else. There are many, many parties and individuals within the pro-democracy camp. And I guess nobody is qualified to speak for all of them. So I speak for the Democratic Party. And it would be very difficult for my party to go out and tell the people, now there is democratic election, but we will give up the right to stand so as to please Beijing. And we will also persuade other people in the pro-democracy camp not to stand so as to set Beijing's mind at ease. I think if we do that, my party would be finished.
Hong Kong Democratic Party Chairwoman Emily Lau speaking with Michael Lippin. Tomorrow, we'll bring you Michael's interview with the head of the city's other main pro-democracy faction. The Civic Party's Alan Leong will tell us why he thinks Beijing should trust Hong Kong residents to make their own choices for leader. The 15th annual issue of State of the Women's World's Mothers, rather, report by Save the Children focuses on saving mothers and children whose lives are at risk in times of crisis. Of the over 150 countries reviewed, at number 15, Singapore ranks as the top country in Asia to be a mother. Catherine Bowles is the Senior Director for Health and Nutrition for Save the Children, and she tells Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonso a large disparity exists among Asian nations.
We looked at 178 countries, looking at the best places in the world to be a mom and the toughest places. And so when we look at Asia, we see that Singapore tops the list and is actually ranked 15 in the overall ranking. Falling at the bottom of the list in Asia, we have Papua New Guinea, Pakistan, Myanmar, North Korea. One thing that's important to recognize, too, is there are disparities within countries. And so we might see in a country like India, for example, some areas that are doing quite well, but then there are pockets that are underperforming, meaning there's not as much access to quality health care for all mothers and children in some parts versus others. So even though we speak about national rankings, we also want to recognize there are real differences in one section or one ethnic group from another.
You list Singapore, South Korea, Japan, and China among the top five Asian countries as being the better places to be a mother. What are those countries doing that have them at the top of the list for Asia?
There are a few countries in Asia that have made incredible advances over the last few years, and some are actually surprising. Bangladesh, Afghanistan, Nepal, some of the countries who are going through significant conflict and have incredible challenges that they've faced over the last few years that have also been doing quite well. And an example of that is Afghanistan, actually Bangladesh as well, over the last few years have cut their maternal death rates in half, and in fact, in Afghanistan by two-thirds. China has cut their maternal mortality rate almost in half. And so what that means is that these countries are making investments in quality health care, and not just for some mothers and children, but setting policy that allows all women and children to have more access to care. I highlight Afghanistan in particular as a country that, despite being in a humanitarian crisis, which is the focus of this year's report, Afghanistan has made significant investments that have saved lives, like changing policies in girls' education, like training and deploying midwives so that moms around the country, even if they can't get to a healthcare facility, can deliver their babies with a skilled attendant.
What is Singapore, South Korea, and Japan and China doing that is really putting them at the top of the list?
Singapore, China, Bangladesh, Japan, Nepal, these are examples of countries that have made particular investments in women-focused policies. They have more women in political power. More women are representatives at a national level, and more women are educated. So these are some of the indicators. The reason we looked at these kinds of indicators in the report is because these really do showcase a story to tell about the health and well-being of a mother and her family. More women that are educated, more ability to make decisions at a local and a national level, greater investment in health of a woman and a child, and greater household economic status. All of those are investments that Singapore and China and some of the higher ranking countries in Asia have made, and we see that that's what places them at the top of the list.
Has there been an Asian country that just slowly, year after year, incrementally improving the situation for mothers?
Nepal would be the example I would choose of a country that has, over the last decade, as you say, incrementally made changes, beginning at the local level and then resulting in national level policy change that has shown how investments save lives. Nepal began to employ some of these very simple solutions. And when I say simple, I'm talking about wrapping and warming a baby and training women volunteers to talk to mothers about how to prevent illness and death in their babies. And over the years, we have seen changes such that the Nepali government said, this needs to be policy. We need to have this practiced all over our country. And in fact, other countries are starting to look to Nepal for those kinds of answers. So infant mortality has declined significantly, and Nepal really tells a story of that. And I think when we look at, even with a country that doesn't have a lot of resources available, some of these solutions are incredibly simple and low cost, but having the highest levels of government support them, require them, is what's saving lives.
Catherine Bowles, Senior Director for Health and Nutrition for Save the Children, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Frances Alonzo, who presents her Women Rising series for us every Tuesday. Just about every day, Steve Norman presents us the latest world news. Guess what? He's back with International Edition up next. We hope you stay tuned. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.